I'm just delighted to welcome back to the show Bill DeBuys. His new book is called A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe on Sunday, the 30th of October at 3 in the afternoon. Welcome back to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here, Mary Charlotte.
So this book, it's just a wonderful, rich book. It's not just, I mean, there's certainly reason for tremendous alarm, but it's not just a book of scary downer stories. It's a book of people stories and land stories and human interactions and politics and metaphors and ideas and science. It's all there. I personally think it should be made into a movie. But anyway, let's start with a metaphor that you use for thinking about climate change. And I was wondering whether you would read this paragraph that you wrote about thinking about climate change in terms of flat water and rapids.
I'd be happy to. The metaphor I use is that climate change is a lot like, or we are poised to go through the rapids of climate change. So I'll read from the chapter that goes into that. You might say that the West, together with most of the rest of the world, is somewhere in the flat water above the rapids of global change. Not that we haven't already felt some of the early effects of an altered climate, but the big excitement lies ahead. Our trip through the hazards will be a first run, which is to say, we'll have the benefit of no one else's experience. Still, enough good science exists to constitute a decent scouting. Looking downstream, for instance, we know that the Southwest will become hotter and drier, with greater extremes of both storm and drought. Increased aridity is assured by higher temperatures, even if precipitation does not decline, which it's likely to do. A greater proportion of that precipitation will come as rain, less as snow, and runoff from winter snowpack will peak roughly a month or so earlier than it used to. These are some of the big rocks and ledges we know about. Other hazards, waves of hyper-powerful forest fires, ecological die-offs, and dust storms, lie downstream, but we're less sure where. We only know to look out for them. Additional and as yet unidentified dangers may also crowd our path, but their present invisibility could be just as well. If we seriously attend to what we already know about, our hands and our agenda will be full.
Bill DeBuys, reading from his new book, A Great Aridness. So when we talk about the Southwest, I mean, it's desert land. It's actually a great variety of climates and microclimates and forest land and farmland and so on, but it's basically relatively dry. What is normal, quote-unquote normal, in the Southwest in terms of the amount of water we have, and how is that changing?
Well, what's normal, and normal is an interesting word in this context, depends on the scale at which you're looking at things. If you look all the way back as far as basically our ability to reconstruct river flow and precipitation, that would take you back to about 700 AD. And normal through all of that past is a good deal drier than what we're used to here in especially that period from about 1975 to 1995, which was one of the most anomalously wet periods in that long, long history.
Which is amazing because, I mean, that constitutes certainly more than my entire adult life, and that is the recent memory of all of us. And so we think that's the norm, but that's actually the wet period.
That's actually the very one of the very wettest periods in that couple of thousand year, in that, what is it, 1300 year span.
We have had droughts. What is the difference between the kind of droughts that we've had in the past, and we can talk about some of the archaeological history of droughts that we've had. What's the difference between the droughts that occur in the natural cycle and what we're going through now with climate change?
Well, in a way, we don't know what kind of drought we're dealing with right now. people understand droughts usually retrospectively. You don't know how long this is going to last. You don't know, in a way, you can only mark approximately where it began. Sometimes, with hindsight, you change that. But there are, in the history of the Southwest, there have been numerous mega droughts, which are droughts that last longer than a decade. We've actually never experienced such a drought in the historic record. Prehistorically, mega droughts are what laid Chaco Canyon low. They're what helped to lay low the Mesa Verdean civilization. And there's a chapter in the book about San Canyon Pueblo and what happened to it in the Mesa Verde country. And that's an interesting kind of mirror in time to look at.
Let's talk about that, because that, I mean, this is one of the great sets of stories that you have in this book. It was, in some ways, San Canyon Pueblo, an archaeologist's dream, because most of the time, archaeologists go into a place which was inhabited, but people left for whatever reason, took their stuff with them. But in this case, people either died there or left so suddenly that all their possessions were there on site. And as archaeologists uncovered them, there was so much evidence. What was that evidence? What did it tell us?
That's right. They left an awful lot of stuff behind, which tells us that when the Pueblo was abandoned, there was a great deal of violence and social discord in that environment. And one of the things this tells us is that, and this is a theme in the book, that no big thing happens for just one reason. Drought helped knock down the Chacoan civilization centered at Chaco Canyon, but even then people stayed in the region. When droughts came that sort of put the final nails in the coffin of the Mesa Verdean civilization, people left the region completely. Everybody went away. What's the difference? Well, the difference is probably that it wasn't just drought. It was also the social dysfunction. It was also the warfare. It was the conflict. And so it's a very good example of no big thing happening for just one reason.
Were archaeologists able to tell whether the social conflict and violence and so on were related to the drought and the lack of food and water and so on that was a result of that?
Well, that's the assumption, that as the drought came on, it started in other places, let's say, before it got to the Four Corners or to the Mesa Verde part of Four Corners. And so probably from those other places, people were leaving and coming to the greater Mesa Verde area. And the arrival of that additional population put strains on the people who were already there. And so they wrestled with the same kinds of issues we wrestle with today. Do you welcome the new people in, make them part of your community? Do you try to hold them off and fight them? All that kind of thing. And they were struggling with those issues, certainly for decades.
Immigration issues go back millennia.
Millennia, absolutely.
So one of the big differences, to my mind, between now and any other period we've ever gone through is there's really no place else to go, because this is a global phenomenon. You can't find another uncultivated fertile field 45 miles south.
Well, that's true, but especially with the prod of climate change, climates are the expression of that in different places will work out in different ways. Some places will become more habitable, other places less habitable. Jonathan Overpeck, a climatologist whom I interviewed at length for the book, he's at University of Arizona. He says there'll be winners and losers, but in the Southwest, it's very hard to find any upside because we're already sort of precariously positioned in terms of our aridity. And so if we get drier, if water supplies drop, then we'll be looking at very difficult times.
We're talking to Bill Dubuis about his new book, A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. Let's talk about the Southwest and why we are so very vulnerable. I mean, one thing, first of all, is that this area has gone through so much population growth, and that growth was not necessarily characterized by smart planning.
It's probably rare in human annals when growth is characterized by smart planning, and the Southwest didn't interrupt that trend significantly. What's interesting about the Southwest to me is that in the 1950s, it was a very the population was very low compared to present standards, and the big projects, the dams, the power plants, and so forth that came online in the 50s and in especially the 60s and early 70s created such a sense of abundance in the Southwest. And this is perhaps just a normal human cycle, but that abundance of a generation ago is now becoming scarcity because there are so many people. These gigantic water systems we've built are just adequate to satisfy present needs. So that if present needs change a great deal, or if supply declines, then we have a lot of difficult decisions to make down the line.
Water is a huge issue in this book, partly because when you have climate change and the earth gets hotter, you have more evaporation, you have less water. Water is already so allocated. Let's talk for a moment about the Colorado River. That is an issue of water management, of politics, of compacts between states and between countries. Give us a sense of the politics and reality of this river.
Well, that would be a very long conversation.
I know.
I just got from the Bureau of Reclamation a book on Colorado River water law, and it's probably the biggest book I have in my library. I could replace cinder blocks with it if I needed to. One point you made is very important for people to understand, and that is as the climate changes, even if precipitation stays steady, the land will become more arid. And that's because the higher temperatures that we're already experiencing and that are going to get higher still assure that evaporation will increase. On the Colorado, as that process continues, if the flow of the Colorado declines significantly, then the kind of vice of difficulty tightens a great deal. The fact is, though, that the states of the lower basin, Arizona and California chiefly, are already living beyond their means, so that even if the Colorado stayed steady for the next 50, 60, 70 years, at the rate they are using water, they will deplete Lake Mead. Big economies need to be found in the way these two states use their water. They need to adjust to a much thriftier water budget.
One of the things, and I forget if we've talked about this on past shows, but that I always find puzzling is that when people talk about water conservation, they always talk about taking shorter showers and not watering your lawns and things like that, when the vast majority of water goes to agriculture, and that's where the real savings is to be had.
That's right. In the future, we're going to see a lot more shifts of water from agriculture to municipal and industrial uses. Conservation, though, is also a double-edged kind of thing, because if all of us use less water, that makes more room for more of us to be in that situation. As people use less and less water, it means that the water they use is water they need to use all the time, every year, no matter what. And that's called demand hardening. When everybody's conserving, it means you can't cut back very much.
Right. As you say somewhere in the book, sloppiness had a payoff, which is that there was all sorts of opportunity to cut back. Although I have to say, I mean, third world people use way, way, way less water than we do. I mean, I've taken perfectly adequate hair washing and conditioning showers using 2.5 gallons of water.
Yeah. I mean, think about how the Hopi have managed their water for centuries. I mean, the gallons per person per day there are might even be single digits.
Right. Meanwhile, what about agriculture? And, I mean, this is both a practical, scientific, and a political question. How do you really achieve the kind of conservation you need to, well, and this is the question, do we want to continue to support growth in the Southwest? Do we have any choice?
Well, as Patricia Mulroy, who heads the water utility for Southern Nevada, says, you know, growth is a train. Nobody wants to stand out in front of it. You can't get it to stop. And one wonders, you know, if we continue to grow, there has to be an end point someplace. There has to be an end game. How do you manage that? Do we just keep going and just keep drying up agriculture and diverting all the water for urban uses?
Well, and we do have to eat.
Yeah, that's the thing. We still have to feed ourselves. We still need the diversity of environments that some free-flowing water will give us. You know, there's no one clean answer to these water questions, but it's a bundle of things that people as communities need to wrestle with explicitly, need to be able to discuss, need to be able to chart a path on that there's some consensus behind.
Do you see any place where they're doing that?
I wish I did. I think that here in Santa Fe, the water managers are doing a pretty good job of trying to keep people involved and really discuss things. We'll see how things go in the future.
One of the things that I thought was interesting about this water manager, Patricia Mulroy, who you just talked about, was that for her, I can't remember exactly how you put it, but basically the idea of self-interest has been shifting to a place where there's a convergence of the common good and self-interest. These things are not necessarily at odds anymore.
Patricia Mulroy is easily one of the most interesting people I interviewed for this book, and actually there are a lot of characters in this story there, and she's one of the great ones. When I saw her, she was wearing a beautiful off-white linen sort of woman's business suit and gold lame ballet flats. We sat down to talk, and she would sort of inquire as she was going along and ask me, "Don't you see?" and look me in the eyes, and I swear I've never felt somebody do that to me in a way that felt more like a headlock. She's one of the strongest, most dynamic personalities I've run into, and she has a great reputation for being a very hard-nosed, tough negotiator on water matters, and running roughshod over people at times. But now she's become almost evangelical on the subject of cooperation. She really sees that as essential, including international cooperation. The United States really cooperating with Mexico on the Colorado.
I mean, Mexico is in trouble if we don't cooperate with them, because we have an agreement to deliver water to them. If we don't, they're screwed.
Well, that's right. We've got to honor that treaty. And the treaty also involves delivering water of suitable quality. It used to be that we sent them heavily saline material over the border and the kind of water that if you irrigated crops with it would kill the crops. The history of the United States' relations with Mexico on water is not a very pretty story.
So when we talk about water, I mean, there are political questions, and then there are just simply science questions of how much water is there, how do we deliver it, how do we keep the water flowing, and how do we achieve sustainability? Has the question of how do we achieve sustainability, and I know you say there's not one answer, but is there some kind of comprehensive solution that if politicians just didn't get in the way for a change, it would work?
Oh, I don't think there's any silver bullet here at all. the challenge for us is that we've got to work towards sustainability more aggressively than we've done in the past. For this reason, climate change is going to lower our water supply. So even as we try to fit current population to current supplies, we really have to fit current population to where supplies are going to be. It's a little bit like what Wayne Gretzky said about playing hockey. He said he didn't skate to where the puck was. He skated to where it was going to be. And so we're kind of entering a Wayne Gretzky era of land and water management. We need to prepare for where things are going to be. And one of the guys I interview in the book, Chris Milley, at the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory outside Princeton, did a fascinating study that was published in 2005, I think, that indicates that surface stream flow in our region is going to decline by 10 to 30%. That's a lot. If the Rio Grande carries, let's say, 20% less water in 2020 than it did in 1990, New Mexico is going to be in a bad way. But the likelihood is that that's going to be the case, or that it will be the case by, say, 2050. So we need to be thinking now about how we're going to deal with that potential future reality.
We're talking to Bill Dubuis about his new book, A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. You talked at the beginning of the show about a lot of changes that are already coming and that are only going to get more extreme. So, for example, changes in precipitation patterns, less snow, rain instead of snow, less precipitation altogether, the peaks of snow and snow melt happening earlier in the season and so on. What does this mean for ecosystems and for wildlife, that some of which are very adaptable, but a lot of which are adapted to very specific conditions?
Yeah, the prospects for some species are not at all good. As part of the work on this book, which was actually a delight to work on, I got to travel all around the Southwest and talk to really smart people about the lands and landscapes that they know best. And I hooked up with a good friend of mine, Peter Warshall, a conservation biologist, and went to the top of Mount Graham. And people may remember the big controversy over the Mount Graham red squirrel. But the Mount Graham red squirrel could be the poster child for climate change.
Yeah.
Because it lives at the very top of that mountain. And as the mountain warms, its forests have become afflicted with various insect outbreaks. There have been terrific forest fires. Basically, the squirrel's habitat has been and is being destroyed by these changes. And they're clearly climate-induced changes. So I don't know how the Mount Graham red squirrel is going to hang in there. Its prospects are slim, but it's a tenacious little creature. And maybe it'll do okay. But it's the kind of creature that lives on a habitat island. And habitat islands are subject to big change when the climate changes. The creature can't move to a new place.
Right. And as you say, some animals that fly can move to a new place.
That's
but
right.
These squirrels who depend on a certain amount of cold or a certain level of cold for their food supply, for various reasons that have to do with forests and pine cones and whatnot, where are they going to go?
Where are they going to go?
They can't go up any further.
The perspective I like to take this story to, though, is that our predicament is sort of like the Mount Graham red squirrel. It's just different in scale, not in quality, because this beautiful blue planet we live on is a habitat island, too.
Right, that's right, exactly. The chapter on the red squirrel in Mount Graham is one of the chapters that I just have to say it's one of the adventure stories in the book, because you show up to check out this habitat and there's a guard there who won't let you in, and there's all, and it just shows the politics of the squirrel, the people who are trying to save it, and the people who are trying to, why didn't they want to let you in?
Well, we did all the right things. We got a permit from the Forest Service, and we checked in at the bottom of the mountain. The top of the mountain has an astrophysical observatory on it. Some of the most advanced telescopes in the world are up there. And we picked up a walkie-talkie and a key to the gate and all. This is a very restricted area. And the area around the telescopes is a squirrel refugium. It's supposed to be a good place for the squirrels. There are almost no squirrels left in it because of the fires and the insects. Anyhow, we get to the gate to this restricted area just shortly after dawn, and I'm pulling the key out to put it into the lock and open the gate so we can drive in, and this man steps out from behind a tree and says, "I'll have to take that key from you." And it's not just a guard. This is the director of the facility who has driven out pre-dawn all the way from Tucson to intercept us because it seems that the names on the permit, I put down my name and I also put down my friend Peter Warshaw's name, and they must have seen the name Warshaw and relayed it up the chain of command and gone slightly ballistic because Peter had been one of the leaders in the fight against the observatory back in the 80s.
Right.
So we had kind of a standoff there for a while, but finally talked our way in.
I mean, I guess that chapter on the red squirrel, well, all the chapters in this book, I mean, it's so much an introduction to human characters who are involved in this. And I was thinking as I was reading about the red squirrel on Mount Graham, these squirrels are very tenacious. They're trying to survive. They're still there. And they have no idea that there are hundreds and hundreds of scientists who are devoting their lives to saving and studying these little animals. And the fact that that's going on there and really all over the world is just in itself fascinating.
I agree, and I think that what thrilled me working on the book, and I hope it comes through in the book, is the quality of these people who are out there in the field, these fascinating and very smart, very accomplished people. I try to tell their stories as I'm telling the stories of these places, and particularly to tell this, their eureka stories.
Yeah.
You know, how it came to be that Tom Swetnam, say, made the connection between El Nino and La Nina and forest fires.
Yeah.
Or how Chris Milley figured out how to go about analyzing future river flows. Or one person after another. These are stories of discovery. And I think, in a way, the book is about the indomitability of the human spirit in trying to understand how this world is working.
And one of the things you say at the beginning of the book is that human adaptation and ingenuity are incredible. I mean, here we are, okay, we're sitting in the Santa Fe Baking Company, which is cooled in the summer and it's warmed in the winter, and we have water coming out of the faucet, although it's not very, there's not a whole lot of water around us out when we walk outside. And we have created civilizations that do all sorts of incredibly wonderful things, even as we are simultaneously in super destructive mode with what we're doing in climate change. And it's almost like, it's not that there's a magic bullet, and it's not that we're in big trouble, but so many people are working on this, and it's like, I think you said, the protagonist in the next act of this drama are we. It's we,
well,
the
right
people.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, we need to help those people work on this problem more.
The scientists, folks. And
but more important than anything else is we need to build sort of a popular consensus that, okay, yes, we've got some challenges here. Let's take them head on and really, really deal with them and not go through the silly politics of one crowd shouting down the other and saying that it doesn't exist.
One step toward that is listening to our scientists. And of course, the scientists have a role in that because sometimes they speak in a way that's awfully hard to understand. But establishing that dialogue among the people who are really studying this stuff and know far more than we do, and the public who are hungry for this information, or should be.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the big challenge, is to get these deep understandings translated into terms and that make it interesting for lay people like you and me to try to understand it.
You had a scientist in the book who went on TV and said something like, if such and such trends continue, 50% of the pine forests in this area will be gone within 50 years, something like that. And then he thought, oh my Lord, how could I have made such a blanket statement? And then it turned out that a little bit more modeling, a little bit more observation of reality, that was exactly dead on.
That's right. That was Tom Swetnam, who heads the Tree Ring Lab down at the University of Arizona. And Tom said that on 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
And immediately felt intense regret, embarrassment, shame, all that stuff. Then later he and some colleagues did a more exact study and sort of graphed out what would happen to ponderosa pine forests over the first half of this century. And they concluded, yeah, we're probably going to lose about 50% of them in the Southwest. And then that was before the Wallow Fire this year that put a big hole in the forests of Arizona to the tune of over 500,000 acres. So these things seem to be moving along in the way that Tom's instincts had told him,
right,
even before the hard data did.
And what's interesting is that, I mean, there's always this process of modeling, observing reality, modeling reality, and then comparing the two, the models and the observed phenomenon, and bringing them ever closer together. And it looks like, in a lot of cases, although the models are not always exactly dead on accurate, they're pretty darn good, and we better listen to what they tell us.
That's right. The prevailing models are holding up very, very well, except in one respect. The changes that they forecast seem to be happening faster than they forecast that they would.
That's right.
That's bad news for us. The models are very robust. They're very strong. But there are feedback loops that they don't have built into them that are occurring in nature that are causing these changes to come about faster than really we were expecting.
Let's talk about the pine forests for a moment. They are vulnerable to all kinds of things. When there's global warming, when there's climate change, there's less water, so they don't have enough water. That's bad for trees. When they don't have enough water, they're more vulnerable to insects like bark beetles. That's bad for trees. Then they're vulnerable to fire as they become weak, and fire is more likely under these dry conditions.
That's right. But this is also another case of no big thing happens for just one reason. The sort of gloomy prospects for ponderosa pine forests in the Southwest are conditioned by the fact that we've tried to keep fire out of them for the past century.
And why was that?
Well, if you go into the history of the Forest Service, if you go back into the history of really wildland management in the United States, fire was viewed as the enemy. It consumed trees, and what we wanted was to have more trees for more timber. And so anything that killed a tree was a bad thing.
Right.
I mean, back 70, 80 years ago, there were even campaigns to eliminate porcupines because, you know, they could kill trees by eating the bark. At any rate, we developed a sort of hostility to fire of all kinds in our management of forests. And as a result, today our forests are way too dense and they have way too much fuel in them. And I'm speaking now really about ponderosa pine forests. You have to be specific as to the ecosystem, as to whether high fuel loads are anomalous or not. But they are anomalous for pine forests. And so just what you were describing about insects and vulnerability to fire, if you have many more trees on an acre than in the past, those trees are competing for moisture. And so each tree, when the drought comes, is more dehydrated than it would be otherwise.
Right.
So the resilience of the system to resist both fire and insects is much reduced.
So when you have natural forest fires, natural wildfires that burn, if we had never been suppressing forest fires, you have these natural fires that are good for the system. They thin the forest. They don't destroy the forest. Then trees grow back and often flourish. Minerals are returned to the soil and whatnot. But when you have these kinds of giant ponderosa pine forest fires that are burning so hot and so intensely because of the extra fuel, what happens then? They no longer are healthy fires.
No, by no means. I mean, there are places over in the where the Las Conchas fire burned, where from the canyon rim on one side to the other, there's not a living thing along the way.
No bugs, no seeds.
This was a terribly destructive fire. The Wallow fire was the same, the Rodeo Chatiskai, the Cerro Grande. We're seeing more and more of these incredibly powerful and really destructive fires. And in the Ponderosa zone, they're blowing holes in the Ponderosa zone that are so big that Ponderosa will never be able to recolonize them. These are areas that are going to come back in ecologies that we really don't know much about. We really haven't seen before. We're going into new territory ecologically in the aftermath of these fires.
There are, and you write this in the end of the book, there are psychological barriers to dealing with climate change. Human beings we're creatures. We evolved. We're primates. We evolved to be scared of large predators and cobras and things like that. But we are not as nearly as adapted or suited to using our rational minds to think of far-off eventualities and making rational decisions about them. And the American Psychological Association has actually addressed this specifically in terms of climate change.
That's right. You actually could fill a pretty good bookshelf with psychological studies of the dynamics that people use or experience in denying climate change. And it seems as though part of the problem is simply cognitive, that people don't really respond to dangers very well that do not involve their emotions and their adrenal glands. If it's all just reason, well, people lose interest after a while.
Except for certain people. And I don't want to say only scientists, because there's many of us who are not scientists who are looking forward in that same way. But, I mean, there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, in fact, working with their minds on this.
That's right. There really are hundreds of thousands. And all these, the different ways that people find to deny climate change, they all come down, in my view, to something that John Kenneth Galbraith expressed better than anyone else. He said, given the choice between changing one's mind and proving that it is unnecessary, almost everyone gets busy on the proof.
Exactly. Let's talk for a moment about some of the mental obstacles, as the American Psychological Association said. Ignorance, uncertainty, mistrust, reactance, denial, habit, impotence, as in what can I do, tokenism, I don't know what that's supposed to mean here, but conflicting goals, and belief in divine intervention.
Yeah, the study of the Psychological Association listed all these ways that people go about denying climate change, and these things, it's almost like a chant or a list of biblical afflictions. All these dreadful ways of of blocking out reality.
Well, and I read this list and I say, where am I in this list? And one of the things that isn't here, unless you can call it belief in divine intervention, is belief that technology will save us.
Well, of course, a lot of people share that. But then again, if technology is going to save us, we have to admit that we've got a problem and start funding the appropriate technologies.
We have to go to meetings to admit we have a problem. We're talking to Bill DeVries about his new book, A Great Aridness. When we have admitted that we have a problem, and our problem is called climate change, and we start dealing with it, and we see how huge it is and how we're just at the verge, unless we do something extremely drastic, of tremendous changes in our land, water, air, climate, the whole lifestyle, the whole thing. There are, as you write in the book, kind of two directions we can go. Mitigation, meaning trying to slow climate change down, and adaptation.
We need to go both directions at the same time, really. Mitigation would be, you know, slowing the pollution of the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. We need to start moving on that. We haven't done anything. We've known about it as a problem since at least 1963.
I didn't know that. Some scientist presented a paper to Lyndon Johnson and said...
In 1963, that's right. Yeah. He was a brand new president.
Yeah.
They said, the climate's going to warm. Warm. We need to do something about this, or
right.
We need to be aware of that.
Many of our listeners weren't born yet.
That's right. So this has been on the agenda for an awfully long time. Incidentally, in a few days, Bill McKibben will be in town. And
yes.
Bill heads 350.org, which is one of the great organizations that's working to address the mitigation issue. So I hope people will be on the lookout for events where they can hear and see Bill McKibben.
What are the most promising directions for climate change mitigation?
Well, the most important thing we could possibly do would be to start taxing carbon. And it could be a very progressive tax, but that's the way you change economies with... It would be what people call a Pigovian tax. It's a way of getting the true cost of things established, because right now the externalities, the negative effects of burning so much carbon, aren't factored into the cost of the
exactly.
fuels
it's
that
a,
it's we're burning.
It's sort of like if you make plastic bottles, if you manufacture plastic bottles, you're responsible for their disposal. It's the same idea.
Exactly. So just getting a true cost factored into carbon in the economy would be the single most important thing we could do.
What about, and this is something that just seems so obvious, I'm surprised it's not talked about more, finding a way to make solar and wind energy competitive with coal?
Well, if you tax carbon, they become competitive. That's the cleanest, simplest way to do it. It's better than subsidies.
Right.
Because you're just establishing truer costs for carbon.
And that is necessary above and beyond getting people to buy the compact light bulbs and all that stuff.
Oh, absolutely. We need to work toward a transformation of the economy. That's the only way that we're going to get out of this thing in good shape.
So that's the mitigation piece. What about adaptation?
Well, adaptation, one of the interesting things to me in working on this book is I discovered, this is a personal discovery, but I, working on these things, I realized that the adaptations that we need to make in the Southwest are really the whole constellation of things that we should be doing anyway. It's all our unfinished business of trying to get our forests more fire and insect resistant and resilient, trying to live within appropriate water budgets, trying to deal with growth in an intelligent manner. All of these things have been on our agenda forever and ever. Climate change simply means that they become more urgent, because unless we deal with them in smart ways as whole communities, we're going to have more catastrophe.
What kind of catastrophe? catastrophes are we talking about?
Well, I think we could see social breakdowns. So we could see breakdowns of water systems. One long passage in the book discusses some scientific papers that look into the possibility of Lake Mead failing. That's a very real possibility. This is an important public discussion. If Lake Mead were to fail, which is to say if the level on the lake became so low you couldn't get water over through the dam, well, downstream of Lake Mead, there are tens of millions of people who depend on water from the Colorado River. So this is a very important matter for the lower basin states, California, Arizona, and Nevada in particular, to deal with.
So basically, our lovely air-conditioned vacation in the spa is over, and we got to get to reality.
We got to get to reality here in the Southwest. And the Southwest is going to feel the brunt of climate change more than any other portion of North America except for the Arctic. We're in the crosshairs of the changing climate.
At the end of your book, you write about climate change as a kind of tragedy in the literary Shakespearean sense. Like there's a form of blindness and there's villains and people who really don't have the greater good in mind. Do you think that the worst tragedy here can be averted? Do you think our lovely American ingenious spirit can triumph?
Well, we can certainly do better than we've been doing. I do think of this as a tragedy moving forward. And, you know, in Shakespearean terms, the tragic hero is someone who cannot see his or her own weakness, the tragic flaw, and can be seduced by Lady Macbeth, or I especially think of Iago from Othello.
Yeah.
Because every time I see photographs of the hordes of lobbyists swarming Capitol Hill, I think of whole armies of Iagos going out there to tell our legislators things that are fundamentally untrue or slanted. So somehow we've got to rise up and take control of this situation and find a way for the true facts of the situation to be accepted.
What is our tragic flaw?
Well, I think it may be we're too comfortable. We're too willing to do what John Kenneth Galbraith talked about, just getting busy on the proof about why we shouldn't have to change our mind and our ways of doing things.
I was thinking also this thing of American exceptionalism, like we don't have to be like everybody else and everything will turn out right just because we are who we are.
Well, certainly a lot of people believe that. That's a good one, too.
Bill DeBuys is the author of a wonderful new book called A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. And I just really urge people to pick up a copy of this book. He's going to be at Collected Works Bookstore on Sunday, the 30th of October at 3 in the afternoon. Pick up the book not to make yourself depressed, but just to read the great stories. And I would like to close by saying that your style of writing is so good and so satisfying, and just the way you use language and the way you structure sentences and the way you use imagery in your writing about the environment and about the people you meet is just a pleasure and a joy to read. So just on that level alone, thank you so much for writing this great book.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Music to my ears.